Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Highland Park, Michigan, and earned an MD from Wayne State University. He began practicing medicine in 1957, and he's been a Beaumont doctor for 60 years and has seen and helped over 400,000 people these past 60 years. A modern day Dr. Marcus Welby, his name, Dr. John Dorsey, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to a modern-day Dr. Marcus Welby, Dr. John Dorsey. Doctor, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, thank you. Honor to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Okay. Well, my father was a physician, and he trained and became a psychiatrist in Iowa, and in memory of him, he got a Rockefeller Foundation scholarship to study under Freud in Vienna. So in my memory, I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan up till 1935. And then in 1935, we went to Vienna and came back in 1937. And he had his analysis from Freud at the time and developed a psychiatric practice and became a professor of psychiatry at Wayne University, not Wayne State at the time, and developed a highly interesting specialty in psychiatry there, to a point where in my classes, some 10 to 15% of the people training there went into psychiatry, so that was his influence. It was very competent. My mother and he were very well balanced with each other. My brother Edward, who was a psychiatrist, retired in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. We grew up together in Highland Park. Highland Park at the time was a very sturdy community, tree-lined. The tax base were two automobile industries there, so that the junior college was free tuition. It was a tree city, and it was really a beautiful neighborhood, pretty much like Huntington Woods, Michigan, in a suburb, because Detroit surrounded it. But it was a nice independent city and functioning very well and very peaceful. And I graduated from Highland Park High School in 1945. I went to Cranbrook in 1944 and came back to graduate in 1945. And then I went into the service and the Navy. I enlisted to become a pilot at the time, and the war ended before that got completed. And I moved back after the service to live there, and then went to the medical school and graduated in 1953. A very comfortable, middle-class family neighborhood, and very memorable.
All right. You mentioned, Doctor, that in 35 your dad took your entire family to Vienna to work with Sigmund Freud, who died 80 years ago, yet he's still famous. For our listeners that don't know anything about Sigmund Freud, tell us about Sigmund Freud.
Well, he certainly was the father of psychoanalysis, psychiatry, and he, in his own way, the way scientists will unearth a common, simple answer, was that the development of the subconscious was really within his work, that the subconscious did a lot of governing of our behavior patterns, conscious or unconscious, and it was quite a thing to develop an energy that was not conscious, and that the psychoanalysis was the prolonged way of bringing out the part that you don't remember. In pediatrics, kids remember incidentals down to maybe 15 months of age, but they don't get into a sustained memory until they're five, six, or seven. Anecdotally, everybody has stories about being a five-year-old, but their work disappears because they're in it. They don't create it. They just are passive, and no matter if they come from a dysfunctional family or a family that's well-established, come weal or woe, the status is quo. Sort of a thing.
How was it you went into pediatrics as opposed to psychiatry?
Well, I probably my behavior, my brother did that. I dragged my home training from my father, who was filled with information that I got when we were in Vienna one time in a park. He was holding a hand with me. We were looking at a tree, and he said, just look at this tree. It's living. Listen to it. And the poetry of that has lived with me ever since, because I couldn't believe that a tree lived. And he said, listen, the wind was in the branches, and it was an evergreen. And I was stunned that a tree could be alive, an early memory like that. And then in my pre-medical years, he would give little statements to me that were just astonishing for me. Like he was told me once when I was 17 or 18 years of age that your mother's not the same person as my wife. Well, that's how life is. My tree is different than your tree. And so two people can't have exactly the same attitude about it. And from that, things grow for behavior, for attitude, for interpretations, things like that. So I went into pediatrics not to become a psychiatrist in pediatrics, but to do pediatric medicine. I had a year of internal medicine before at Henry Ford Hospital here in Detroit, and I was bored. And I switched to pediatrics because I like the people working there, and I've never looked back.
When we come back, speaking of being astonished, we're going to ask Dr. Dorsey about the miracle we call the human body. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul, and we're with Dr. John Dorsey, who's been practicing medicine since 1957 and still going strong. Doctor, the miracle we call the human body.
Yes. And the miracle I feel with all my heart will always be a miracle. I don't think we'll ever understand. Every year we rub the surface of our body and new things are being discovered in genetics and medical interpretations of our brain, how our muscles work, everything. And we're down to the essentials of what is life. Well, I think that the body will always stay a miracle. And that's something that people, I guess, take it for granted that you have a body and you have a life, and some people misuse it and some people use it. And in my interpretation and practice of medicine, the golden nugget of a child's development is self-esteem. That when you're held in esteem, basically you have esteem. And in a way, as my dad once said, you'll do for yourself to the degree of what you think you're worth. If you think you're worthwhile, you'll look out for yourself. And if your self-esteem is low and you don't look out for yourself, you generally won't. You'll not take advantage of things around you. You look at things differently. The color of their tree is different than my tree, for instance, for my lifetime. And there's a saying that two men behind bars, one sees mud, the other sees stars, which is true. People have an outlook on life, and it's either sometimes just either up or down. And energy for living, I feel, comes from seeing life with gratitude. As I get older, obviously, you reflect more like this way. So every morning when I wake up, I'm just plain grateful that that I can see colors, and I'm appreciative of every season that Michigan offers, and everything that is right.
Following up on miracles, Talk to us about the miracle of birth.
Well, there's a saying in medicine called ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, and that is that we start off like single cells, then two cells, then four cells, then 16 cells, and so on. And we go through actually a fish stage. We have gills as in our embryological stage. So in a way, we're sort of like a fish in a way. And as we grow, we look like a shrimp in the beginning, and then the messages that emanate from our genetic scheme of things, the color of our hair, the color of our eyes, the way we walk, is plugged in. And we grow, and you come into a viable fetus, if you want to use the word. You're not an embryo anymore, and you're a fetus now at 4 months of age, 2 months of age, really. And the world of fetuses is such that in neonatal medicine, now you can have babies that are born at the weight of a box of candy, 2 pounds, even 1 pound, 1.5, and they'll live in their self-styled medical uterus and come out and land on their feet simply by the science of understanding prenatal health. There's prenatal surgery. They lift out a baby in the uterus, prepare something, and push him back in again now these days, and they do that all the time.
We're talking to Dr. John Dorsey, and his career began back when doctors made house calls, of which you made thousands.
Well, yes. We had, by far, the emergency rooms then didn't have the staffing of specialists, and an emergency room was really an emergency room, so that in the 1950s and 1960s, we could get up to 7 house calls in a night, and we had searchlights on the sides of our cars. You'd get out at night at 2 o'clock in the morning, have to go up and look at a sign of a street in order to get to the street. And people that I see now, because I had, when I started practice, I had 16-year-old kids who are now in their 60s and 70s. So they're my patients. As a matter of fact, when I'm in the office, my manager will sometimes catch me to go out in the hall because I have 3 generations standing in front of me, the grandmother, the mother, and their child there. And there's a great reward in that companionship that other people don't get.
Talk to us, doctor, about the importance and the need for human touch and hugs for a child.
Well, when I was being taught my physical medicine, there was a saying about you observe, you inspect, and you palpate. And that's what you do with every patient that you see. And it becomes an automatic habit. You listen. We have 2 ears and 1 mouth. And sometimes we should let the ears do the talking. And there's an old saying that if a patient talks long enough, they'll make their own diagnosis. So you develop a patience toward listening, and listening without having to be interrupted by an electronic system that you have with you. You have high contact in the eyes. And the touch in medical school, it was quite a frightening thing to draw my first blood, putting a needle in. Dentists have the same issue when they have to invade somebody's body, and it's quite a thing to touch somebody else. It's really a privilege, and the touch, I feel, I'll have people who go to our hairdresser, and because that person is touching their hair all the time, they wind up almost in psychoanalysis with their clients. They reveal because they're being touched. Physical people who do massage work and body language and stuff like that, it opens up something. And there's, back in the Middle Ages, there was something called the king's touch. And it was very common for the king of England, say, that to once a week he'd have his people lined up by the hundreds, and he'd listen to their story, and then he would touch them. That's all they had. They didn't have penicillin. And many times people got better because the king's touch gave them a sense of cure, management, stuff like that. And even today, we need tactility, and which is beginning to disappear in medicine. It's becoming more and more remote. And so the touch is really, it's a subliminal, essential quality of infants who have no, they're not, even babies who are treated disrespectfully or with malice will come out better than the kids who are ignored completely, the babies.
We're talking to Dr. John Dorsey, who still runs a practice of seven-person practice in Bingham Farms and in Sterling Heights. Doctor, talk to us about the toughness and the courage of sick kids.
Well, kids have no idea of what's sick and what's healthy. Whatever is, and they accept it pretty much up till age 4 and 5. That whatever is, they don't complain because there's nothing to compare it with. They're really whatever is. As we get older, we say, "I wish I didn't have this cancer. I wish I didn't have this. I wish I didn't have that," and they have this quality of believing what's in front of them. If they believe that there's a sickness, which is not interpreted, it's just you don't feel well, you take it because there's no answer to it. You don't have anything else except maybe by the way people are looking after you. And many people don't have that quality of being looked after for the first 4 or 5 years. So that a growing child is completely in the hands of a parent. One way or another, they're completely innocent, by the way.
We're talking to John Dorsey, and I'm Jack Prasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Prasula, and we're with Dr. John Dorsey, who for the last 60-plus years has seen and helped over 400,000 young people. Speaking of which, when we were kids, I don't ever remember hearing the word autism. Now, one out of every 60 young children have autism. Doc, why?
Well, it's a runaway diagnosis. They broadened it out because the people are diagnosing autism now, and they broadened it out to something called ASD, or Autistic Spectrum Disorder. In other words, the kids that used to be weird and different are not weird and different
anymore.
That
was anymore. Every one of us.
That they have autistic spectrum disorders. And the new word invented by an Austrian psychologist during World War II when Vienna was being bombed is Asperger. His name was Asperger. And Asperger found, I don't know where the world when they're ducking bombs, how they has time. He had time to decide in his mind that there's a profile of people who are just a little bit fey, they're just a little bit off-center, they're intelligent, they get along by themselves, they don't need a lot of friends, they're very intellectual, they're happy as clams, and they're just a little touch different. They're successful, or not, maybe not. And so the diagnosis is more by misdiagnosis many times, because some kids aren't autistic. Maybe they have a language problem with speech, and so they have a delay in developing a relationship with their siblings or their parents because they have an expression disability, expressive aphasia, receptive aphasia, which the autistic children do have. So sometimes the diagnosis is overextended and then not. But at any rate, it's too bad because sometimes somebody will get nailed with that diagnosis and that's in their medical chart for the rest of their life, that they might be that way. And I think that a lot of the broadness of that diagnosis comes from kids who are just a little bit different. And I think they should just stay a little bit different. Don't give them a diagnosis.
You've met tens of thousands of moms of every flavor, every race, socioeconomic. Dr. Dorsey, what's a mom?
Well, a mom is basically a person who nurtures and nurtures for the first 5 or 6 years of a youngster's life, and probably the handling of him with esteem, love and affection and esteem surrounding. That's the idealism for a mother. It can't come from the father as much because he's off doing other things. And for the first five or six years of life, the mother is the one who tells the father to take Chucky to the drugstore. I need some things, and then come on back. Dinner's ready in 20 minutes or something like that. And around 6 or 7 or 8, they begin to move into the father's influence. If they're boys, they want to be like their father. And if they're girls, they want to be like their mother. They start making choices. But a mother is a person who's the caregiver. And that's the day and night caregiver, the one who changes the diapers, the ones who's up at night when they don't sleep as much. They're the ones who go out for walks. They're the ones that take them to the doctor 90% of the time. And they're very powerful. I mean, they can do an awful lot of dysfunction or function. And sometimes they're very often in my counseling in pediatrics as part of my medicine is that people will feel that they're not doing the job that they should be, but they are. But sometimes they don't understand the resilience of children. And I think sometimes the way they were raised is the way they raise. And sometimes they don't like the way they were raised, but they're doing this recapitulation of the way that it was for them. So that's how they do it to their own children. And they don't like themselves because they're doing what they never wanted to have done to them.
What would you say tonight to a new dad?
Well, a new dad should change the diapers too. He should be there. She's up dangling as a breastfeeding, bottle feeding, and he really needs to be a companionable companion. He's alongside of her and understands her issues. She has to understand his. He's coming home from a hard day, and it's hard for him to take on the energies of a father at night. But there again, the esteem that's offered his son or daughter goes a long way toward gathering self-esteem. Because again, it's the energy that makes you look out for yourself. And sometimes the golden rule of do unto others, you do unto yourself. Sometimes you can stub your toes because sometimes you don't like yourself, so you don't do a good job looking after other people very well either.
If there's a couple listening tonight, Doctor, with a few young children, and they're thinking about divorcing, what would you say to them?
Well, that no matter what, the youngster who's the victim of this divorcing, this separation, I think they turn it on themselves and they think that maybe they have it. Like, they will universally say, honey, I love you with all my heart, but I'm not going to live with your mother anymore. Well, what about me, Dad? If you love me that much, then why don't you stay here anyhow? That sort of a thing. Well, I can't, son. I have to move to California. And then sometimes they will compete with another marriage, and it's hard work. And sometimes it can be doable. It's not all divorces are rendered with violence, and sometimes they're sophisticated and so on. But you have to understand that there's a no matter what age there is, there's somehow the sturdiness of that combination is bent a little bit. And I think they can make up for it in time, but lots of times they're very vulnerable. Not lots of times, they're always vulnerable.
We're talking to Dr. John Dorsey, who's been a pediatrician since 1957 and still runs a 7-person practice.
Well, I don't run it. They run me a little bit.
a father tonight, a dad tonight, who's abandoned his children.
That's hard, because in the beginning he may have reasons for the abandonment, and I think as they get older, I think universally, if they're any kind of a human being, they'll understand that they could have done it differently, but in a funny way, they can't. They're stuck. They're doing the best they can. Otherwise, they'd be doing better. That's something my dad taught me, and that's a hard thing for a kid to understand. Just very quickly, your grades, how are they in school? Well, they're not too good, but I'll do better next year. Well, in a way, that's a subterfuge, because really they would be doing better if they could, and they can't, so they don't, and they're stuck with it. And sometimes fathers abandon their children, have an enduring problem, but it's very tough on the children because they don't understand. Remember, their father is not the same person as their mother's husband, again. And it's very difficult to segregated that way, to where there's a competition with another wife, another children's setting. And I'm waffling here a little bit because there's no easy answer. They're both victims.
We're talking to Dr. John Dorsey, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dr. John Dorsey, who has been a Beaumont doctor for over 60 years. Doctor, a lot of people say you used to make house calls.
Yes.
The reality, sir, is you still make house calls because your wife, Lorraine, is in an assisted living facility. She's 88. You've been married 45 years, and 2 to 3 times every day, you go to see her.
Yes.
That's house calls. Talk to us about Lorraine.
Well, the settings for people who are older sometimes involve diseases because you just live that long. In other words, Parkinsonism, dementia, things like that that just reduce your ability to become independent are there. And sometimes they need what's called assisted living, obviously, and they need help. And I think that nursing homes that provide this also have an environment of loneliness. And sometimes when there are periods of lucidity and they're very much aware that they're not doing what they used to do, things have been swept out from underneath them, the neighborhoods stop existing, the driving together in a car stop existing, just going out to supper together stops existing. And so the loneliness is really for everybody who has a parent or a wife or a loved one in a nursing sort of a thing, has that toxic environment of being alone. And I'm very much aware of loneliness, and I'm not doing it like I'm making a house call. I'm doing it because I want to. Sometimes we have our best conversations there too. But philosophically, sometimes when there's lucidity, and then sometimes there's not. And it's a sense of obligation and responsibility, certainly, but it's also love and affection and sturdiness and solidity of unity of a couple. And I feel that I'm doing the best I can by being over there a couple times a day for a couple hours at a time.
Only about 10% of doctors keep practicing past the age of 70. You're age starts with a 9.
Yeah.
And you've been practicing pediatrics for over 60 years. Talk to us about the practice of pediatrics in 1957 versus today.
Well, oh yes. It's a, well, it's a loss and a gain. The 1950s were made up really of listening, observation, and analyzing what the data that you got, and then the physical examination part, the touching, the things like that. But the main point was paying attention, and I think that patients who feel that they've been patients or parents of patients, if they feel that you have been honestly paying attention with genuine listening and with patients. Well, by the way, a lot of people retire because of burnout. Sadly, they just burn out from medicine because they're worn down from the work that's being asked of them these days. And I think that my bulwark against burnout was the ability to develop patience to a point where it's a second nature to be patient. And I think that's being lost today as science increases and the communication style has become electronic. And sometimes even when a doctor is on his computer and he's taking his eyes off the patient, and he's computerizing the data in there and getting valuable information to be stored. It's all valuable, but sometimes the contacting is missing these days. There's a distancing that's taking place, but at the same time, the science is increasing, and there's a value. It's like a teeter-totter. You lose some and you gain some. And I think that the old-fashioned way then in the 1950s was that a physician was like Dr. Marcus Welby. They did make house calls. And patients who are in their 70s who I see remember the house calls that I made that I've forgotten all about. So again, your words carry a lot of weight when you're in medicine. You make a statement, and sometimes the patients never forget what you said. And
You're 92 years old. You had colon cancer in 2014, 5 years ago. You had bypass surgery in 2007, 12 years ago. You still practice part-time Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Friday mornings.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's first of all, it keeps me together from doing what I love to do, and I'm grateful to my practice for being able to do it that way. I don't have to sit and ponder life at an isolated corner somewhere. I see it right in front of me unfolding, and it's stimulating and it's energizing, and I feel that I'm still learning. And I still, as my dad, who was well-known in Detroit, was asked about his 75th birthday in the Detroit Free Press one time, and his answer was, well, how do you feel about being 75, doctor? And he said, well, it just makes me feel young longer, and which is a wonderful thing to do because I feel young doing what I've always done, and I do feel young even though I don't look young. And I think that point of view about not getting older but staying young longer is an attitude, like the tree.
You look a lot better than you give yourself credit for, and you sound extremely young.
Yeah.
You mentioned learning. You love to read, and I quote you now, I love learning.
Yes.
If there's somebody 50, 60, 70, 80 who's kind of ready to give up, how do they get back to love learning?
Well, I think curiosity is a quality that drives you to learning. And I think the optimism, again, you're upbeat toward morning, you're grateful, grateful for learning. I'm grateful for learning. I'm trying to keep up with all the stuff that in our medical journals. And I can keep up with part of it. A lot of the old stuff, I have to do it my way because I'm too used to it. But I just, at the end of the day, I'm as refreshed, no matter how tired I am, I was as refreshed as when I came in the first time. So why shouldn't I go to a place where I'm rejuvenated, literally, physically, and mentally every day? I'm grateful for being able to do it. People who have to retire at 65 or 70, I feel bad for them because they're still young. They really are young.
You've helped over 400,000 babies and children.
Okay, now, but add the phone calls too.
Millions, okay?
Right, yeah.
And the house calls.
Yeah.
When you look in a baby's eyes, what do you see?
When I look at them and they look back at me, I love the intelligence of a 15-month-old or a 1-year-old or a 9-month-old staring at me, interpreting me because I'm in the doorway and I'm coming in and I'm not swooping down and picking them up right away. I'm giving them a chance to judge me because already at 9 months, they're judging strangers. They're very much aware of strangeness. And sometimes you can see the intelligence in their eyes and the way they pay attention to you. And there's an awful lot you can see by observing, but wanting to observe and enjoying the observation. I've trained myself to notice flickers of things, and doctors who listen and watch and look will get so much more information out of somebody that even helps in their diagnosis. It's a value system I wish were taught more in school.
Are you hopeful about the future of America?
Oh, totally. The kids that come in the summertime for their physicals, they are self-perpetuating, self-analyzing, self-producing. And the new definition of adolescence now quits at 25. And I'm seeing 16 and 17-year-olds who do their homework. Their grades are good. Their parents like the kids they bring home. Their self-esteem is reasonably good. And these are the silent majority of American kids, all of them, no matter where they come from, there's a sturdiness in our country that still exists. And our, as far as I'm concerned, our country's right on the right track. The parents are raising kids that are worthwhile kids.
Well, you're another example, a shining example of the greatest generation. Well, stay young, keep it up.
Thank you. You too.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall. Believe in yourself.